Welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure, brought to you by the Global Infrastructure Investor Association. Now more than ever, governments around the world are recognizing the importance of partnership with the private sector to deliver the transformational investment required to meet global challenges. But how do we deliver the enormous scale of investment needed to close the infrastructure gap in an affordable way, whilst addressing societal challenges such as net zero commitments, climate resilience, and the digital economy? GIIA and its members are at the forefront of this debate, and Talking Global Infrastructure is the podcast that will delve into these subjects and more to bring you valuable insights from the experts in the sector. Hello, I'm John Phillips, Director of Corporate Affairs at the Global Infrastructure Investor Association. And for the sixth episode in our podcast series, I'm delighted to be joined by two guests from Deloitte. Patricia Buckley, who is Managing Director for Economics for the US firm, and Ian Stewart, a partner and chief economist in Deloitte's London office. Today, we're going to be discussing the current headwinds for global investors in infrastructure and looking ahead to the prospects for the global economy in 2023. Hi, Patricia and Ian. Thank you both for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Hi, John. Delighted to be here.
So to start us off, I noticed that the editors of the Collins English Dictionary have declared their word of the year for 2022 to be permacrisis. The definition of permacrisis is an extended period of instability and insecurity, which seems like a very fitting choice to me. Given that the infrastructure asset class is built upon a platform of stable, predictable, lower risk characteristics. The 2020s haven't been a very accommodating few years so far. Ian and Patricia, can you unpack the last 12 months for us a little bit? And how does this period of time compare to other periods of downturn that you've experienced or have knowledge of?
Well, John, in the UK and Europe, what we've seen is a huge inflation shock. It was building last year, the end of last year. Perhaps the big surprise in the fourth quarter of last year was the strength of inflation. But of course, it was supercharged by the rise in oil prices and energy prices caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I think the central problem for policymakers and for economies in the West has been coping with the effects of very high inflation, inflation that hasn't really been seen for more than 30 years. And then increasingly from spring onwards, a rapidly increasing pace of monetary tightening as central banks respond to high inflation and concerns that inflation could become embedded. Now, we know from history that big shocks in inflation and sharp rises in interest rates tend to be the harbingers of at least slowdowns and often recessions. And the UK, we end this year with the UK economy probably in recession. And I think that in 2023, we're likely to see the euro area and the UK for most of the year in recession, with recoveries starting to emerge towards the end of 2023.
The outlook for the US, I think, is actually a little more optimistic than that. What we're seeing with inflation, I mean, the initial jump was on the durable side, and a lot of that we could have attributed to supply chain issues rather than excess demand, but both were at play. There was a lot of savings built up during the pandemic, and with all the supports that were going out to individuals, consumer demand remained high. So with the durables inflation coming down, that's a good sign, because you know that's the supply chain issues we knew eventually were going to work its way out. And now we're starting to see the headwinds from the Fed tightening play out in, you know, rising interest rates. And so far, it's the major impact of that's been on our housing market. But looking forward, I honestly think the U.S. can probably skate through without entering recession. we're expecting slow growth both in the first and second quarters next year. But after that, we're hopeful, absent any more geopolitical shocks, that the U.S. economy can resume a growth path.
And what's your assessment of the lingering effects from COVID and the way that the lockdown has impacted on supply chain, work patterns, and even the availability of the workforce? How is that impacting on the overall picture, Ian?
Well, the pandemic was, of course, a huge shock, not just coming out of nowhere, unanticipated, but it's the sheer scale of it. This is the biggest contraction in the UK economy in 300 years. It was, in terms of the shrinkage of the economy, it was like four really big recessions put together. So this was an astonishing shock. And what it caused was a huge dislocation between demand in the economy, which was suppressed by lockdowns, and supply, which of course was also affected by lockdowns and uncertainty. Now, when the reopening started, consumers came out of this huge downturn with actually more money than they'd entered it because of support from the government. And demand was constrained. Production had been affected. And so you hit sort of a lot of demand hitting economies where supply was constrained. And of course, that resulted in inflation, much stronger than expected inflation. And at the same time, commodity prices, which collapsed in the spring of 2020, rebounded very strongly with the global recovery. And we saw very significant dislocation in supply chains, which just had not been built for these massive shocks. Now, at the same time as the West was recovering, of course, China was pursuing its zero COVID policy, which has caused significant disruption in supply chains from China, the world's manufacturing workshop, which has added to pressures. And we're starting to see some of the unwind of these effects. Supply chain pressures have eased. Commodity prices are coming down, and consumers are switching away from the discretionary spending that we saw in 2020 and 21 towards more staples. The other, I think, lasting effect and profound effect of the lockdown has been to dramatically accelerate the move to hybrid or agile working. And that's particularly strong in the United Kingdom within Europe. So we think this is a step change towards greater hybrid working. It's still an experiment. People are still trying to work out how to make it operate for them. But I don't think we're going to go back to the world of February 2020 with the levels of working in office that we then had. I think this is a permanent change.
I agree. We're seeing very similar things in the US. And what we're just beginning to appreciate is the impact on cities themselves. So if the hybrid workforce becomes permanent, which I think it will, you know, just think of what it does to, you know, coffee shops, to parking garages, to dry cleaners. There's a whole host of support that is having to be rejiggered. Public transit is another good example. So city planners are having to rethink exactly how, you know, central business corridors are going to be organized.
So we've looked at a little bit of the UK and the US specifically. Ian, what's your prospects for mainland Europe, and how do you see that panning out in any different way to the UK during the next year?
Well, I think that there are a lot of similarities between Europe and the UK. Obviously, the UK has seen headwinds from Brexit and the disruption to trade that has come as a result of it. But both the Europe and the UK have been affected by this huge energy price shock. And as Patricia says, it's one of the differences with the United States is that their gas market operates partly independently of ours. Gas is a difficult commodity to ship. If you don't have very, very long pipelines, you've got to liquefy it and then regasify it at the other end. So Europe's seen a major shock in terms of energy prices, and that is particularly important to in economies such as Germany, which had a particularly high reliance on Russian energy. Now, I think the good news in Europe is there has been a quite astonishing reduction in European use of Russian oil and gas since February, far faster than anyone expected. Use of Russian energy is probably down about 80% in the space of what, 10 months. And that's really good news, but it's come at a price. It's come at the price of much higher energy prices and significant adaptation, greater efficiency. And of course, it's also been helped by the fact that until very recently, the winter and the autumn have been unseasonably warm. I think for next year, we are looking at a recession in Germany. Germany is the powerhouse of Europe. And if Germany goes into recession, I think the rest of the euro area will as well. There's a big squeeze on consumer incomes with inflation running well above wages. Debt servicing costs are rising. And I think it would be very surprising if we didn't see unemployment rates, which of course have been a real bright spot for Europe and for America in this cycle, but if we didn't see unemployment rates start to rise. So I think we are looking at a recession which in the euro area comes a bit later than in the UK and runs through most of next year.
And how about other parts of the world, Patricia? Any other areas that you would highlight?
Well, China obviously has been impacted by its zero COVID policies, and it looks like they might be loosening up a bit there, and they've got the longer term issues with their property markets. The spillover into other economies cannot be underestimated. You know, everybody from Australia to Brazil depends on exporting to China. And you look at, you know, nearby economies, you know, Japan, they had negative growth in the third quarter, but they're looking fairly solid because consumer spending is kept up. Where Japan is going to be at risk is as the rest of the world slows and the slowdown continues into 2023, their export market will suffer. And so it'll constrain growth, but they're still projecting around 1% growth in Japan.
Now, geopolitics plays a pretty large part in the global economy and shaping the global economy. And we're obviously seeing quite a few developments recently in that space, not least perhaps a straining of relationships between the European Union and the US on the back of arguments around subsidies contained within the Inflation Reduction Act. There's the Belt and Road Initiative versus the European Commission's Global Gateway Initiative, the G7 Global Infrastructure Plan. Lots of high-level kind of programs potentially competing with each other or rubbing up against each other. What sort of role do you see those having in terms of, you know, major trends to watch out for during the course of next year? Can I come to you first, Patricia, on that?
Yeah, no doubt these programs are going to be competing with each other. And it's kind of funny that in the U.S. it's called the Inflation Reduction Act when it's creating demand at the same time the Fed is trying to slow demand. But if there's anything that we know for sure with government programs, the announcements are big and immediate, but the rollout of the funds, you know, take years. So our Infrastructure Act is now a year old. And while $185 billion have already been announced, you know, the spending, the rollout of that spending actually, you know, is slower than certainly the people who are trying to access the funds would like. But there's no doubt it's causing trade tensions, the U.S. and Europe in particular, with a lot of the subsidies that are going out for clean energy, for example.
And anything from you on that one, Ian?
Yes, I think we are in a world where in all sorts of ways globalization is being challenged. And of course, kind of global integration was one of the driving forces of the rise in growth rates and living standards between the late 70s and so right up to the financial crisis. And the pace of globalization or integration has certainly slowed. I think there are a combination of factors. One is a more volatile economic environment, which has made governments concentrate more on problems at home. I think in some countries in the West, and of course particularly in the United States under the Trump administration, a kind of fatigue with what were perceived as some of the negative effects of globalization in terms of, say, manufacturing jobs and wages. You've seen a rise of tensions between Russia and China on the one hand and the West on the other. And then, as you say, the Inflation Reduction Act has not met a warm reaction in Europe. On the contrary, it's seen as a measure which will provide a lot of support for US industry in a way which Europe sees as unfair and increases the pressure on Europe to help its industries in kind or to erect barriers to US companies. So, I mean, it's certainly a more difficult environment for globalization. Actually, if we look at the data, globalization is continuing. So we are seeing, you know, high levels of financial movements across borders, trade, of international movement. But I think the rate of increase of globalization has slowed. And I think for big organizations or operating across borders, the environment is more complex and requires more time to negotiate.
Well, thanks both for that. So if perma-crisis was the word of the year for 2022, perhaps resilience should be the word for 2023. What should investors in infrastructure be focusing on in 2023 to make their investments and their assets more resilient in these turbulent times?
I think it's interesting, the perma-crisis and the resilience part. It's almost as if we're crisis resilient. So companies, I think, need to think on the longer term and try to smooth out the peaks and the troughs of these, you know, the combination of geopolitical, climate, all kinds of things that are challenging the world, as especially with infrastructure programs. You know, you're thinking forward 5 years, 10 years. So it's, where do you expect your company, where do you expect the world to be looking forward?
And I think building on that, that we are going to be on the other side of this downturn in 12, 18 months' time. And I think for all companies, and particularly infrastructure companies, they have a lifespan well beyond the ups and downs of the economic cycle. And I think it's therefore interesting to think about the themes which will shape the world economy beyond the recession. And I think an obvious conclusion from everything that's happened in recent years is a growing focus on the part of policymakers and corporates on how they can strengthen systems against risk. And that could be, you know, in terms of governments, the risk of conflict for policymakers and for business, the risk of stress in supply chains or the financial sector, and for I think the energy industry, this huge challenge of the transition to away from hydrocarbons. And I mean, to me, John, this is an environment in which you know, part of the response in terms of resilience is building infrastructure and strengthening infrastructure, and particularly energy infrastructure. And it seems to me that what we're seeing is the start of an industrial revolution in the way in which energy is created, stored and distributed, which will have profound effects across the economy, but will run for many years. And I think that will be something which will mark the economy in a much more profound way than the vagaries of the economic cycle over the next 12 months.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Thank you, guys. So perhaps just to, as we move towards the end of the discussion, maybe flip the discussion a little bit. And, you know, with all of these challenges facing governments around the world, surely the role of private capital in helping to deliver much needed investment in smart, resilient, sustainable infrastructure for the future has never been more important. And yet, in many cases, we're seeing a really mixed signals coming from governments. Windfall taxes in the UK, unfavorable regulatory conditions, populist sort of measures that don't really serve to attract the kind of international investment that stands ready to invest. So how do you see governments responding to this during the next 12, 24 months? You know, who looks best placed to secure more than their fair share of this global private capital that is waiting to be deployed in these areas?
Well, just from a European point of view, I think you're absolutely right, John, that we're in a world where governments need the private sector to invest. They need to speed the energy transition, and they are constrained in terms of their own balance sheets. I mean, government borrowing, of course, rose dramatically during the pandemic and then before that in the financial crisis. So in a world in which there is quite a lot of capital in the private sector, far more than there was on the eve of the financial crisis, the obvious place to look is the private sector. And I think the challenge for governments are to manage the shorter-term risks around maintaining energy supply, containing the price of energy and its effect on the economy and the household sector, and to get the economy through the recession without creating disincentives for the private sector to invest. And those are particularly disincentives in terms of creating uncertainties, or by dramatic moves in terms of things like taxation. So I think it's these things are always a balance. But I am struck as I look around the world that I think that if you were looking for deep pools of capital, they tend to reside in the private sector, in sovereign wealth funds, private equity, with institutional investors. And I think governments need to be kind of creative in finding ways of unlocking that capital, and also very mindful of the possible effects of their actions during the downturn on the kind of incentives and attractiveness of investing in quasi-public assets.
Yeah, I think you saw this really clearly with the G7 proposal, for example. That $600 billion is public-private money. It was never intended, you know, to be billed as this is what the governments are going to do. And times of crisis, as Ian mentioned earlier, look how much Germany, for example, has been able to reduce energy use. Companies have gotten, when a commodity is cheap, you use more of it. When it gets more expensive, you know, you figure workarounds. And one hopes with these larger programs that we see the real benefit to the citizens that these programs are, you know, designed to serve, by being very creative and getting things moving in ways that reflect what we think the pricing and the risk profile will be going forward.
Well, thank you both. It's been really fascinating to listen to your insights on this. So just to close the discussion, I'm going to just invite you to, in one sentence, paint a picture for next year. When will we be over peak of the downturn, if that's not a contradiction in terms, and when can we really start to see growth returning in a meaningful way in the major economies?
In the U.S. economy, I think, you know, the first half of the year, as I mentioned, I think will be weak, but I think growth is going to pick up in the second half of the year. All this with the giant caveat of that the slowdown doesn't disclose some sort of financial crisis we didn't expect, and that there are no new geopolitical crises erupting.
And I think in Europe, John, we are looking at perhaps 3/4 of contracting activity through 2023. But I think that by the autumn of 2023, we're going to be hearing a lot more about green shoots and about recovery. And I think that by the end of 2023, we'll be looking at an outlook which is much brighter. So much lower inflation than now, much lower interest rates, and the prospect of recovery through 2024. So it's going to take some time to get there, but I think that Europe will see a recovery panning out towards the end of 2023, which will be assisted by that pickup in the US economy that Patricia mentioned, along with what seems likely to be a relatively strong performance from the Chinese economy in 2023.
Well, thank you for leaving us with an upbeat message, as upbeat as possible, perhaps in, under the circumstances. But time will tell. I very much hope that you're right in terms of the green shoots returning before the end of 2023, and fingers crossed that's the case. Ian and Patricia, thanks so much for your time and sharing your thoughts for GIA members and other listeners to, of our podcast. We really appreciate it, and look forward to catching up with you both soon.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to Talking Global Infrastructure. For more information about GIIA, please visit our website, giia.net. And look out for the next edition of our podcast by following us on LinkedIn and Twitter.